Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 11:55 our time on this day 70 years ago, Imperial Japanese Navy staged a surprise attack on the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor. Five U.S. battleships sank or were severely damaged, several hundred warplanes destroyed, and more than 2,400 people died. December 7, 1941. On December 8, President Roosevelt addressed a joint session of Congress referring to the events of December 7 and the action the U.S. would take.
Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack.
This morning, there will be 3,000 people attending the commemoration at the Pearl Harbor Visitor Center overlooking the USS Arizona Memorial in Hawaii. There will not be many who were at Pearl Harbor as those numbers are dwindling. People are dying with advanced age, with ill health of the membership and the declining numbers of members. They, as a matter of fact, are even discontinuing the Pearl Harbor's Survivors Association. That announcement will be made today. So it will be up to us to remember and to listen to the stories now captured on tape and on movies. What happened on that day in history, a day that will forever live in infamy? We're going to talk about Pearl Harbor Day this hour of the program. Professor John McManus is our guest, Assistant Professor of History and Political Science at the Missouri University of Science and Technology at Rolla. He teaches courses on the Civil War, World War II, Vietnam, military history, and the American combat experience in the 20th century. He had an opportunity to study the Normandy battlefields firsthand. He has overseen a major effort to collect the firsthand stories of American veterans of World War II. He is the author of The Deadly Brotherhood, The American Combat Soldier in World War II, Deadly Sky, The American Combat Airman in World War II. He contributes frequently to World War II magazine. In 2004, he published a two-volume series on the American role in the Battle of Normandy. His first book was Americans at D-Day, The American Experience at the Normandy Invasion. Second book, The Americans at Normandy, the Summer of 1944, and he has written a number of other books as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for you. Some of you may have been alive and able to hear the news on the radio, as millions of Americans did on December 7, and will remember that day pretty vividly. You may have had relatives who served in Pearl Harbor, and we're particularly interested in hearing your remembrances this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor John McManus, thank you very much for joining us on this day.
Morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm so struck because the number of people who were members of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association, the number of people who remember that day vividly, are beginning to dwindle significantly because People are dying. And we do need to remember that day. It won't be firsthand remembrances in just a few years.
It's coming up far too quickly. And it's very sad. I mean, I remember being a graduate student 15, 20 years ago and dealing with quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors at that point in time. And the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association has really traditionally been one of the strongest and obviously the most history conscious of many of the World War II Veterans Associations. So I certainly do not welcome the passage of time in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how Americans got the news 70 years ago today. When did the first news reports come out?
Some of the first news reports came out in, I believe, the early afternoon in the Eastern time zone. Most people heard by the radio initially, and then it just kind of traveled by word of mouth. And as I understand it, quite a few people, when they initially got the news, their reaction was, where's Pearl Harbor?
Mm-hmm.
What's Pearl Harbor? The average person didn't necessarily know that much about where the Pacific Fleet was stationed or indeed what was in the offing. But one of the things that has struck me is there was a Redskins football game going on in Washington, and the news broke during that football game, and there was the PA became just inundated with all sorts of announcements about this officer needed to report there, and this person needed to do this, that, and the other thing. There was this sort of murmur in the crowd, like, boy, something's really wrong here.
Mm-hmm. So it was a matter of news reporters all over the country trying to, as was the case after September 11, get up to speed on what was happening here and what the history and where the military was and why the Japanese came and everybody's number of ships and all that information had to be learned.
Yeah, exactly. It's learned on the fly. And just, there's, of course, always this confusion inherent in an event like that, and so they're quite dependent, as I understand it, on the Honolulu bureaus of the various news organizations to get them information as quickly as they can. And so it's just sort of breathlessly reported over the radio, which is really the you know, innovative medium of the time. And so then people, quite a few people, spent the rest of the day just clustered around the radio. Mm-hmm. It was a very funereal kind of event in that respect.
Something that we don't often remember is that the Japanese attacked the British, what was it, about a half hour or an hour before they attacked Pearl Harbor?
Right, because the thing to remember about the Pearl Harbor attack, it's really just one element of a larger offensive, what the Japanese called their centrifugal offensive, in which they're moving upon all British interests in Asia, including, of course, Burma, Hong Kong, eventually Singapore, and what used to be known as the Dutch East Indies back at that time, Dutch colonies in Borneo and Java and the like. And, of course, the American-held Philippines, which will be hit within half a day of the Pearl Harbor attack, Wake Island, Guam. It's a massive offensive in which Pearl Harbor is just one piece of it, but kind of the centerpiece. And also, you know, pretty much anyone from that generation will tell you exactly where they were and what they were doing when Pearl Harbor happened.
Oh, yes.
It's one of those events.
Right. I'm sure they are. The Roosevelt administration and other allies were, I'm sure, keeping track and were alarmed by some developments that were taking place in Japan in the previous years before 1941, going back to the 30s. What was Japan up to, and how worried were we?
Well, the Roosevelt administration was deeply worried, and I think on the eve of Pearl Harbor, understood that war was imminent. It didn't necessarily have a full appreciation of where the blow would fall. A lot of people expected it in the Philippines, which, of course, eventually it does. But, relations between the United States and Japan had steadily deteriorated since the late 30s, and most of it had to do with the Japanese invasion of China. The Americans were part of the kind of infamous open door to China in the earlier 20th century. Not necessarily an imperial domination of China, but certainly an economic domination in many respects. And the Japanese were part of this as well. But the Japanese had come to the conclusion by the 30s that they did not have access to the kind of resources that the United States and Britain did. And if they were ever going to compete as an equivalent power, they had to find a way to access resources like oil and iron ore and so on and so forth. They were too heavily dependent on the United States. And so this is really what the crux of it is by the end of the 30s, the Japanese not wanting to continue the status quo in Asia and the balance of power that had been kind of informally enforced by the colonial European powers. And the United States has to basically face the fact that if it wants that balance of power, it's going to have to fight for it And of course, as everybody knows, the U.S. was very unprepared for that.
Mm-hmm. And was the attack timed at this particular moment? Not that it would have happened a little bit later, because the U.S. had cut off the shipment of oil and other materials to Japan, and they really couldn't build what they wanted to unless they had that?
Most definitely. The Roosevelt administration in 1941, in the summer of that year, in reaction to the Japanese occupation of, ironically enough, Vietnam, North Vietnam, which was a French colony at that point, the Japanese began to encroach on Southeast Asia. And at that point, the Roosevelt administration decides to basically push the Japanese into a corner by cutting off oil, scrap iron, and freezing Japanese assets here, in the hopes that this will be a kind of a trump card to shape Japanese behavior in Asia. Well, instead, it kind of forces the Japanese into a more militant posture. And they had decided, the Japanese leadership considers among basically three options in a major meeting in September. Option one was to accede to American wishes, withdraw from China, so on and so forth. Well, of course, this was not in any way considered seriously. This was not Japan's mood at that point. Option two was to attack the Soviet Union, which is at that point fighting for its life against Nazi Germany. And the Japanese did like the idea of going into Siberia. There were oil and timber resources that appealed to them. Option three was to move on the European colonial powers in the United States, and obviously they're going to decide to do that, provided the negotiations that President Roosevelt referred to did not bear any fruit by late November. Well, obviously they hadn't, so the centrifugal offensive is put in motion at that point.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the time that was picked for the Japanese to ally themselves with Nazi Germany.
The time when they picked that, or
yeah, why it was 1940, was it?
Right, they signed the Rome Berlin Tokyo Axis, hence the name the Axis Powers. And it's really kind of an informal alliance. They're not really obligated in any formal way to coordinate with one another, and they really don't coordinate with one another very well, much to their detriment during the war. But technically, if one is attacked, the other must come to their aid. So Germany was not necessarily obligated under the treaty to declare war on the United States, but it does so. And that's viewed as, of course, a major mistake by Hitler a few days after Pearl Harbor. But Hitler had felt that the Japanese had really eliminated America's major threat, its naval power. He miscalculated, but he felt that way in the wake of Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the mood of the United States, which I'm sure is fairly nuanced, but would it be fair to say that there was a good deal of isolationist sentiment before Pearl Harbor, but it was changing, the sentiment?
Yeah, it was evolving. There was quite an argument going on in this country between those who wanted to assist the Allies as much as the U.S. possibly could, and those who really wanted to stay out of it and felt this was not necessarily our business. A lot of this had coalesced into, I guess, a consensus by the end of the summer 1940, after the fall of France, that the U.S. ought to prepare for war, even as it still hopes to avoid it. And I would say on the eve of Pearl Harbor, at that point, you have the United States Navy fighting an undeclared war with German submarines in the Atlantic as a result of the Lend-Lease Act that Roosevelt had passed after being reelected in 1940. The U.S. is really drifting a lot closer to war, but the public, the average person at that point, is highly sympathetic to the Allies, wants to help them, but doesn't necessarily want to be in the war just yet. And Pearl Harbor, of course, evaporates that towards a mood of I would say, national vengeance against Japan as much as anything else.
Tell me how bad the destruction was.
The destruction was just absolutely terrible. You've got really eight battleships that are either sunk or heavily damaged. Now, five do return to service at some point in the war. There were several other ships sunk. Over 2,400 Americans are killed, 1,100 wounded. Of course, almost half of those who were killed aboard the USS Arizona, which goes down very quickly. 68 of those killed were civilians, and some of these civilians were actually killed by American anti-aircraft fire as the shells go up, they explode up there and flak comes down. And you got a very chaotic situation that's quite unsafe, and there are quite a few unlucky souls who are killed that way. One of the things that's most prevalent at Pearl Harbor is people being burned to death. Sailors aboard ships as the oil catches fire or explosions or what have you. Just terrible, terrible scenes of the water basically on fire with oil slicks, sailors either on fire in the water or trying to swim their way through it. You have a lot of major puncture wounds as sailors are flung around aboard their ships. They're being flung against bulkheads and sometimes into sharp ends of things, and you've got major puncture wounds that come from that. Just an awful, awful circumstance. Most of those who were involved with the medical side, I mean, literally remember almost rivers of blood in their hospital wards, whether it's the naval hospital that was right as part of Pearl Harbor, or the civilian hospitals, or also Tripler Military Hospital, which was the Army hospital in Honolulu.
We're going to welcome phone calls in just a moment. We're remembering Pearl Harbor Day 70 years ago today, December 7, 1941. One of those who was in Hawaii and a fairly young man at that time and has subsequently had a distinguished career in the military and a distinguished career in Congress. He is the senior United States Senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye, who has been a senator since 1963. He is the second longest serving U.S. senator in history after Robert Byrd, and he plans to run again in 2016 when he will be 92 years old. He is from Hawaii and was in Hawaii that day, and this is how he remembers December 7, 1941.
My name is Daniel K. Inouye. I am a United States Senator from the state of Hawaii. On December 7, 1941, it was a Sunday, and I was getting ready to go to church with the rest of the family and listening to the radio at the same time, and all of a sudden the disc jockey began screaming into his mic, telling the listeners that Pearl Harbor was being bombed and devastated. And so I grabbed hold of my father, and we went out into the street, looked westward towards Pearl Harbor, and sure enough, the skies were filled with puffs of anti-aircraft shells exploding. And suddenly, three fighter planes flew overhead, and I knew what had happened. It was one of the darkest moments in my life, because those men who were piloting the plane very likely looked like someone like me.
Senator Daniel Inouye, remembering December 7, 1941. We will take your phone calls and continue our conversation with Professor John McManus, Professor of History and Political Science at the Missouri University of Science and Technology at Rolla, and teaches many courses in World War II. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls, let's start with Elizabeth in Washburn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. Go right ahead.
Oh, I just called to say that I was at the University in Minnesota at the time, and on the morning that President Roosevelt gave his speech, everybody was in the student union, and it was dead calm. No talking. Nobody talked to anybody. And we all sat and listened. Or stood, really, is because there wasn't that much room to sit. And after the speech, just most of a good portion of the young men in the room got up and enlisted. And that's the one thing I can remember. And they didn't say, I'm going to enlist or anything else. They just got up and went. And it was just nobody really said anything at all, and that's the one thing I can remember most of all.
And did this affect your family? Did members of your family enlist, Elizabeth?
I had, yes, and I had a cousin on the Arizona at the time.
Oh.
And he was, of course, in the water, went down, and then they had to bring him up, and he had the bends at the time. I can remember that because I had no idea what the bands were or what they did, you know. But he did live, quite a while after that, yes. And my brother was in, and my father was in, and my husband. I was married then about 8 months after that, so. It was a long stretch.
A long, very difficult stretch, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Professor McManus.
Yeah, a lot of folks have a lot of similar stories. Just this somber, gathering around the radio, and literally everybody affected by this. And what strikes me is that how fortunate your cousin was to have survived as a member of the crew of the Arizona. I believe that only about 300 sailors from that ship actually survived the attack.
How many people enlisted on December 8 and in the week following?
Multiple thousands. Mm-hmm. The recruiting stations were absolutely inundated that week. Because part of it is just your bureaucracy of how things work is heading in that direction. In other words, the attack happened Sunday, and then everybody's reared and ready Monday morning when the offices would open. So almost coast to coast, you see them just flocked with young men, and that's the other thing that strikes me about your recollections is that everyone, or a lot of these young men, just kind of silently went and enlisted as soon as they possibly could.
Thank you, Elizabeth, so much for calling.
All right.
Let's go to Neva Dale, who's from Texas but is in Wisconsin. Hi, Neva Dale.
Hi. This is Neva Dale.
Hi, Neva Dale. Go right ahead.
I was living in California in December of 1941. My family had left Michigan. We had sold our home and put all of our possessions in a 26-long trailer, 6 feet wide, and moved across country looking for work because my father was in construction and all the materials were going to Lend-Lease. So there was no work of that nature to be found. And so we just kept moving until we got to California. And it was, within the year after that I was sitting in that little trailer listening to the radio, and it was interrupted by this very excited announcer saying that the Japanese were bombing Pearl Harbor, and it just was so heart-rending. I was 15 years old, but I had that momentary thought, this was going to change everybody's life.
How did it change your family's life?
Well, it just, as it did with all war people, families were separated.
Mm-hmm.
What I did after that, I ran outside and found my mother and my father and my sister, who was also a teenager, and we got in our car, and the thing to do, they were saying then, is all servicemen needed to be returned to their bases immediately, all leaves canceled, everybody was to go back to their base. So everybody, and the highways were crowded with cars out there, picking up servicemen, hitchhikers, and taking them back to their bases. There were a lot of bases around there, March Field being the biggest one of the Army base, and taking them back and then going back out on the highways and picking up people again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. One of the things, my sister and I were young. We weren't drafted. I subsequently married a man who was a survivor of the three battles in the Pacific. So we're a very strong veteran admiring family. But my sisters and I, neither of us were actually in the service. But my father, one of the jobs that he was able to get there was building of in Azusa, California. They went in and stripped out all of the orange blossom trees and built barracks, and this was used as an internment camp for the Japanese.
Oh, my.
And you know, at the time, I can remember my dad going, taking us and showing us the site, and we were thrilled with the orange trees. Michiganders are really excited about orange trees and being so excited about it, but we were so thrilled that he had a job.
Oh, my. And little did you know...
I was in college studying political science before I realized the infamy of that act of building that that concentration camp for those Japanese people that were citizens of our country.
That is quite a memory.
Oh,
what,
yeah.
What about your husband? Did he talk very much about his time in the Pacific, or was he quiet about it?
He was stone quiet.
He was.
He had a couple of funny little stories that he would tell. And I'll tell you one of them. He may want to bleep me off. And
no, that's all right. We won't bleep you.
The last big one that he was on, he was on Peleliu, which was awful, and then he was on Tarawa before that, and then he was on Okinawa as the last one. And he said that he always told the kids his claim to fame that he was the first man in first Marines to land on the beach at Okinawa and have a ball moment. Now, that's not just the way he worded it, but that's what he meant.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the call, Neva Dale. That's quite a memory, isn't it? Her father building the barracks for the Japanese internment.
Most definitely. I mean, the other thing about it, too, is just the sense of motion and chaos in the wake of the news and servicemen having to report back to their bases. Because the other thing to appreciate, and it's sometimes easy to forget, 70 years removed from this event, is in the chaos and the confusion of that day, they didn't know whether this was just the attack on Pearl Harbor was just the beginning of a Japanese invasion.
Right.
So, especially in the West Coast, there's a lot of concern that an invasion is coming. And Pearl Harbor has been such a stunning, military strike that many Americans think, well, the Japanese are capable of practically anything. They could be anywhere. So there's a tremendous amount of fear along the West Coast over that. Question.
And what about in Washington? What about with the Capitol, et cetera? Were there guards immediately put in position?
Most definitely, yep. There were guards immediately put into position all over the Capitol, around the Capitol building, the White House. Everything was on a very, very heightened state of alert at that point. And as it turns out, for no great purpose, because the Capitol wasn't going to be attacked. But they didn't necessarily know that at that point. And that's part of, some of that kind of fear and, hysteria leads to Executive Order 9066, the infamous executive order to intern Japanese Americans, primarily on the West Coast, that follows from all of this. They are an easy target. And I think it's very intriguing, the lady's story about her father being involved in the building of one of those camps. I suppose that would have been a fairly common experience for a lot of folks in the construction trade there.
You didn't have a chance to respond to what Senator Inouye said, but imagine having those planes come in that attack, and as he said, they were people who looked like me.
And that is, of course, so from Senator Inouye's point of view, it's not only a terrible event of his country being attacked, but he's going to have to worry about the requisite ethnic and racial tension that's going to eventuate from that, too, and obviously he was a perceptive person who understood exactly what that tension would be. There's another kind, and I don't remember the person's name, but she was a Japanese American in Los Angeles and had lived a normal life, as a high school student or college student at that point. And literally the day after Pearl Harbor, all of a sudden she became very, very conscious of her ethnicity because everyone was, staring at her in the most hostile fashion imaginable, even former friends. This had to be just a really staggering and troubling experience for them.
Neva Dale, thanks for your call. We go to Ross in Madison. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Kathleen. Season's greetings to everybody. I'm 51 years old, so I wasn't alive during that time. I did spend 20 years in the military, most of it reserves, but some active duty. So some varied comments. The parallels between the bombing in Pearl Harbor and the bombing in New York City, sort of that this evil genius and how it seems like these things we sort of get caught unaware. I think of the I haven't studied it, but the thought and the perception was is that the radar technology at the time wasn't really maybe capable, this might be the question I would ask the professor, but it wasn't really capable of catching this kind of a surprise. The thought that the United States had put all eggs in here with all these stuff Harbor wasn't the smartest thing to do. And then the last comment I was thinking was is how the Japanese, as I understand, had a professional military somewhat sort of divorced from the maybe society at large. And the concern that I have in terms of today's military is if we allow a professional military to get so big, sometimes the concern is utilized as a powerful tool.
All right, I need to hold you there. I'm sorry, Ross, but your phone is a little bit intermittent here. But we have the major part of what you've said. Professor McManus.
Right, the Japanese armed forces, there's no question that they're major political players by the late 30s and the early 1940s. In fact, the Japanese government is really dominated not just by the emperor and aristocrats associated with him, but by army and navy officers. And there's a tremendous antipathy between the army and the navy over you know, war policy and what to do. Whether they were divorced from the average Japanese, I don't know about that quite so much, because I think that the Japan had the draft, and so military service was quite a universal thing. And so the armed forces were actually fairly close to the average Japanese, so it's not quite analogous to, say, the all-volunteer military force that we have now in the United States. But as far as the radar technology of the time in World War II, of course, there were radar sets on Oahu that did pick up the approaching Japanese planes. It's just that the American technicians did not really know what they were looking at. They knew there was a flight of B-17s coming in from the American mainland, and incorrectly assumed that's what they were seeing on the radar screens. The folks who were manning those radars did not necessarily have a lot of training for that job, and the radars were only up 3 hours a day. So in the end, that early warning system really went kind of by the boards. But one parallel, too, that I think is quite valid is just as for that generation from 1941 remembers where they were when Pearl Harbor happened, I think it's very clear that in 2001, that generation that experiences 9/11 certainly remembers where they are and what they were doing when that happened, too.
Yeah, no doubt about that. What about his point that we put too much of our military in this one spot?
In Pearl Harbor.
We had too much there.
Oh, right. Yeah. The thing about this is that FDR had moved the fleet from the Pacific Fleet from San Diego, where it was based until 1940, to Pearl Harbor. And the irony of the whole thing is he did that partially as a warning to Japan, as a kind of a deterrent. Well, instead, as it turns out, the fleet turns into a target, and I think a more strikeable target, because it's hard to envision how the Japanese could have successfully hit the fleet in San Diego. I suppose they might have tried, but it would have been a more difficult proposition for them. So the fleet, ironically, is more vulnerable at Oahu. And the other thing about this, too, is that the Pearl Harbor facilities were much more compact, and thus the ships were closer together. They were really a more inviting target in the mouth of that harbor, which certainly didn't work to the advantage of the Pacific Fleet that day.
Mm-hmm. The Japanese must have undertaken pretty meticulous planning to pull this off.
Yeah, they really did. And this planning for them had been in the works for years. Multiple years.
Really?
As a concept, yes, it had. And like Admiral Yamamoto, who was really the leading naval thinker for them and kind of to some extent the architect of the Pearl Harbor strike, is sort of first intrigued by this idea in a book he reads in the 1920s about a notional war between the U.S. and Japan. But it really becomes more of a concrete intention as of 1940, when the British had demonstrated that such a carrier-borne strike would be possible. The British in the Mediterranean had launched planes from aircraft carrier, I think it was Illustrious, HMS Illustrious, and hit the Italian port of Taranto in southern Italy, and had sunk two Italian battleships, and it really kind of altered the naval balance of power in the Mediterranean. When that happens, the Japanese really do understand the feasibility of what they can do in terms of striking a fleet in port. And they really have the leading naval aviation in the world at that point in time. And so they have months of meticulous planning for this, and they have excellent intelligence. Here's the irony of the whole thing. The Americans are so concerned with sabotage and with the loyalty of Japanese Americans and all this business. And they have their planes lined up wingtip to wingtip, which is, you know, one of the most infamous examples of Pearl Harbor. But really, the Japanese didn't need all that. They had their consulate right there in Hawaii, and they had a former naval officer who was assigned to the consulate, and all he did was go around each day and take a look at the fleet and watch how it operated and take a look at the patterns, and all very legal.
Yes.
He gathered tremendous amounts of information that was quite useful to the Japanese aviators.
It's December 7, 2011, and we're talking about what happened on this day, just a few hours from now, our time, in Hawaii. December 7, 1941, 70 years ago today, Pearl Harbor, the surprise attack launched by the Japanese Navy on the U.S. Naval Base at Pearl Harbor. Our phone number, we have one line open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Here's Pete Seeger's remembrance.
It was Sunday here, and Woody Guthrie, he and I and Lee Hayes, we were having a hootenanny. And in the middle of it, somebody burst in saying, "Hey, the Japs have bombed Pearl Harbor." I didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was. He said, "Don't you know it's the big Navy base in Hawaii?" Aha. We were at war, finally. We could see it coming, but now there was no turning back. Finally, the pressure of the American nation was going to be put into fighting Hitlerism.
Meetings of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and its committees that relate to this broadcast station are generally open to the public. Certain meetings or portions of meetings may be closed in order to address confidential information or proprietary matters. More information about specific meeting dates, times, and locations is available on the WPR website at www.wpr.org.
History in every century records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we get the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Professor John McManus is our guest this hour. Was that the rallying cry for much of the war, remember Pearl Harbor?
Particularly for those who fought in the Pacific Theater. And I think it's really fair to say that Pearl Harbor kind of sets the tone for just the ferocity of the Pacific War. The American people are determined to have vengeance against Japan. And the Pacific War is a war fought with really no quarter asked or given on either side. There's a tremendous amount of racial and cultural hatred on both sides. The level of ferocity of the battles is almost beyond belief. The lady who called earlier talked about her husband being involved in the battles of Peleliu and Okinawa. As a combat historian, it would be hard for me to imagine instances in American history of more ferocious or really barbaric battles than the battles fought there.
Why? Why were they so barbaric?
Because by then, you've just got this deep antipathy on one side or the other, and it's become almost a war of annihilation. The Japanese are so determined to resist to the bitter end. They have most of their soldiers follow the Bushido warrior code, which means you don't surrender. You fight to the end, regardless of whether you're facing defeat, and there is honor in that, that it's not a matter of whether you've actually won the battle, but whether you have earned your honor. And this is, of course, deeply important to them. So, for instance, among those 10,000 Japanese, and most of them are elite soldiers who fight at Peleliu, most of them know that's a one-way trip. And so they end up fighting against the 1st Marine Division and the Army's 81st Infantry Division, really to the death. And the Americans could not conceive of that kind of dedication to the emperor or whatever. And they were just determined to annihilate anyone in their path, because the Americans, of course, wanted to survive. And they were using firepower as heavily as they could. And that's obviously an American technique of war. So it really just gets to levels that are almost unimaginable. And I do think Pearl Harbor is a major variable in that, the way the war started.
Bill in Lancaster. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My grandpa would have had a very interesting time of hearing about Pearl Harbor. He was on Wake Island at the time. He was a civilian contractor working for, Morrison Knudsen? And he was building an air base on Wake Island, which I'm sure most people know, though it's mostly been forgotten, was attacked just a couple weeks later. And the Japanese took over 1,000 U.S. civilians and put them into forced labor in Chinese camps for the rest of the war after that. So my grandpa was a slave to the Japanese for 3 or 4 years.
Mm. Did he talk about that with you, Bill?
No, it really bothered him a lot because he had the rest of his life was a very, very hard time. He didn't talk about it at all, and he started opening up towards the end of his life, but he passed away about a year ago. But I have a letter that the Japanese forced him to write to say that he was being treated well, and I have some other things of his that kind of chronicled his time.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you have that. It's important to write those stories down, isn't it, Professor McManus? It's really important now because everybody's dying.
Most definitely. It really is to preserve that history. And we, you know, World War II folks have generally done a very good job of this. The more, the better. And I would also encourage, folks from younger folks from other periods in American history to do the exact same.
Yes.
So important.
It sure is. Thank you, Bill, very much for the call and email. From Sylvia, I was a young girl riding in my father's 3.5 Chevy on our way to Superior, Wisconsin, a bustling iron ore port in those days. The announcement came over the car radio. When we drove into Superior, newsboys were shouting, X-ray, X-ray, read all about it. Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. It was scary, and the first time I'd ever heard newsboys, my father said, I think we'll be in this war sometime soon. I thought he was the smartest man in the world. We went to the cathedral the next day to pray for peace. I bet a lot of people went to cathedrals and synagogues and all kinds of places of worship that afternoon.
Most definitely. There's one of the things that's interesting about it, there aren't that many times in your life when there's a moment when you realize everything is really changing. And I think there's a sense of that after Pearl Harbor, that no matter if you didn't know where it was or whatever, that you had a sense that your life was really about to change, that the world had been altered pretty dramatically. So it's a pretty somber nation at that point.
Deborah in Madison, hi.
Hello, thanks for the show. My father was at Hickam Field when Pearl Harbor was bombed and had some interesting stories. But 10 years ago, my sister and brother and I accompanied him to the 10-year anniversary, 60-year anniversary.
Oh, you did? Oh.
Now, that was 3 months after 9/11.
Oh.
And tourism was way down, but the governor of Hawaii had offered, I'm not sure exactly, free vacations or something to the firefighters and police officers of New York. And two stories that I remember from that experience was being in an elevator with a man who had a New York Fire Department hat on, and he had about a 5-year-old with him, and he said to his son, shake this man's hand. He helped protect your freedom and keep us free. And the little boy shook my dad's hand, and my dad said, and just so you know, don't forget, your dad also protected our freedom. And everyone in the elevator was crying.
Oh, my, I'll bet.
The air was just full of honor in Oahu then with all these veterans.
Mm-hmm.
But it was at their meeting where people were all revved up, all these veterans, and someone said, well, see you back in 2011. And someone raised their hand and said, maybe we should start doing these every 5 years.
Mm. Yeah.
But it was a wonderful experience to be there with the veterans, and the Hawaiian people were so welcoming of them, and it just was an honor to be there.
Oh, I'm so glad you have that memory. That's making me cry. That's really something. It's those honor flights that have been going to Washington too have been so meaningful to World War II veterans, and unfortunately we're coming to the end of people who are alive who will remember that. So it has to be through their children's memories like you and your children's memories, and on it goes. So we remember.
Yes, yeah. Dad would do do speaking engagements in high schools, and he was always disappointed that in the last 10 years or so that the kids had no idea what December 7th, 1941 stood for.
Did you see the piece in the New York Times this morning? One of the speakers for the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association recounts an experience of being at a school, and he's introduced by one of the teachers saying, here's Mr. Harry, I can't remember his last name, Harry Kiever or Kivi or something like that, who's here to talk about Pearl Harbor, and a young girl in the audience says, who's she? Yeah, we can't have that, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Can't have that.
That's where I come in. Trying to educate college students, at least, and it's true. Many do. You know, once they get to my classrooms, they don't necessarily have the foundation of all this, and I'm only too happy to give it to them.
Thank you so much, Deborah, for your call. And we'll go next to Paul in Madison. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. My father was stationed at Schofield Barracks, Territory of Hawaii, on December 7, 1941, serving in Company K, 21st Infantry Regiment. And his story was rather interesting because the day before, the regimental football team played the 98th Coastal Artillery for the All-Hawaiian Football Championship. And he set up a punt. The winning score was a 66-yard punt return. And I remember when I was young and he told me the story, I rather imprudently asked, well, how come you didn't score? And he said, well, I ran out of gas. And he said, of course, the next day the Japanese gave us our presents. And but it was a very quick change from a very idealized life. James Jones recalled Schofield Barracks as being one of the most beautiful posts in the world to the next day being in a war. And we're losing those men who were there at that time and every day. And so this is a very meaningful program for me.
Thank you, Paul. I think it is for all of us. Thanks very much for your call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hi. I had the unusual privilege, I guess you could say, in retrospect. My college roommate was Japanese, and his father fought for the Imperial Navy. And I got to know him and his family quite well over the years. In fact, we're still in contact. I'm 60 years old now. And it was very interesting hearing the Japanese public's point of view. He was in the military, but Japan was, the emperor was worshipped as a god, more or less, but the actual running of the country was pretty much a military dictatorship under General Tojo, and it was not a democratic country, but public opinion was very divided in Japan, at least according to my friend's father. He remembers his thinking to himself that with a lot of Japanese that when the Japanese public heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor, they thought, oh boy, we are in the doo-doo now. And, of course, the Japanese were patriotic people, and they fought bravely and with great enthusiasm to the very end. But there were a lot of Japanese who thought from the very beginning that they were going to lose that war, that it was a mistake.
Professor McManus.
It would have been some, but one of the problems too, you mentioned quite correctly that this was not a democratic government in the least, and so there's the Japanese government controls information quite well during the course of the war and kind of sells many of the Japanese people on the idea of Japan's invincibility. Yamato Damashi, Japanese fighting spirit, will triumph over all, and that there are just victories being won one after the other, and initially that's true. But the great wake-up call comes really later on by 1944 when the Americans take the Marianas Island, and General Tojo's government collapses at that point. Not much substantively changes, but there is a real appreciation on the part of many really thoughtful Japanese that the war isn't going as well as the government says, and that they are really in trouble, as the gentleman had indicated.
Email from Barb, who remembers the bombing of Pearl Harbor. living in Southern California, the things that stick out are the feelings of fear, the city lights being put out or dimmed so the enemy would not be able to see where the cities were, the sound of sirens, the warnings to keep our blinds drawn, and as a result, the regular air raids, car lights and factory windows being painted bluish, having to sit under our desks at school for regular air raids, the sentries walking the beaches, the reports of enemy planes being overheard or submarines off the shores. We worried about friends and relatives who were being what seemed like immediately called up. And that was happening all over this country.
Right, and you got to remember, too, you're about 80 years beyond the Civil War, so there's almost no one who remembers what it's like to have a war here on soil. And so it's a really jarring and disturbing experience, particularly for a nation who has many people who believe that its oceans will protect the country from these sorts of things.
Yeah.
So Pearl Harbor seems to be the wake-up call.
Right. Professor McManus, thank you so much for spending this day with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Professor John McManus, our guest. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for doing an exceptional job on getting sound and putting together this program, December 7, 1941, 70 years ago today. This is the Ideas Network.
What is your name?
Norman Weissman.
Do you live in Washington?
Yes, I live in Washington.
Well, how did you feel about when you first heard about the Japanese war?
Well, I felt I'll be called into the draft pretty soon. I'm eligible. I'm in one-day classification, and it hit me pretty bad. I didn't expect it so soon.
Well, I was surprised that it was so sudden.